Folks, our guest today is Jenny Bradley Lichter. Jenny has just taken over now as the president of the March for Life. And of course, she has a long history in the pro-life movement. You can read about some of that in her biography that we sent out. Jenny, thank you so much for taking time to join with us today. We wanted to have you on if we could, because we know we just had the March for Life, and we really wanted to accentuate the importance of that issue and not allow it in any way to be diminished. So thanks for joining us. The floor is yours. Can Jenny hear me? Marlon, can you hear me?
Okay, I just got a message that said I was unmuted. So can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now, yes.
Okay, terrific. All right, well, thank you very much for the invitation and for the beautiful prayer, to which I'll say amen. Good afternoon to all of you. I'm joining you from the March for Life headquarters in downtown Washington and on just the second business day in my tenure as March for Life president. So this call is one of my first official acts, you could say. I just became president of this organization on February 1st, although I had joined the staff in November in president-elect capacity. I basically was sort of learning from the previous president as an apprentice for the last few months, which was terrific. So I'm happy to be with you all to talk about the March for Life. I thought I would just briefly introduce myself, and that since this is the first time we're meeting one another, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about what my organization does. We'll talk about this year's incredibly exciting National March for Life that happened just about 10 days ago here in D.C. And then I'll share sort of my thoughts about where the pro-life movement is in this moment, and then I'm happy to take some questions in our remaining time and hear some thoughts and feedback from all of you. So first, again, since this is the first time I'm joining you all and since I'm brand new in my role, I'll just tell you a little bit about my background. I'm a lawyer, and I've had many roles over the years in the public sector, in the private sector, and in the nonprofit sector. I worked as a lawyer for my church, the local Catholic church here in Washington. I was a lawyer for Catholic University, so learned a little bit about faith-based higher education most recently. In the first Trump administration, I was a senior policy advisor in the White House. So I was the deputy director for something called the Domestic Policy Council, where I worked on all kinds of issues, including housing issues and labor issues and education-related issues and tribal policy and workforce development. But what was closest to my heart in my portfolio from that experience was working on pro-life issues and on religious freedom issues and issues involving the faith community. So I was blessed to do a lot of that kind of work in the government in the first Trump administration, which I'm really grateful for that experience because I think it will help me be a good partner to the current team, the person in my old job and all of the policy team in the current White House in the next administration. Going back even further in my professional history, some of you probably know of the Family Research Council. That was actually where I got my start in D.C. It was my first grown-up job after college about 20 years ago. I was a research assistant at the Family Research Council, again, working on pro-life issues and religious liberty issues. So I've been in and around the pro-life movement for a long time, even though this is my first kind of full-time job as a pro-life advocate. Relevant to this new job in particular, I'm a longtime marcher. I started coming to the March for Life when I was a freshman in college, and have been coming ever since then with, you know, initially just with friends, and then started bringing my husband. And then when we had children, we started bringing our children to the march. For kids, it's a really impactful experience. And if any of you ever have an opportunity to bring your children or your grandchildren or nieces or nephews to the march, I think it's just really powerful for little kids to realize that there are so many other people who also care about babies and their moms. You know, that's the framing we use with my kids, especially when they're little, when we don't want to get into all the details about abortion. We just say, we love babies and their moms, and we pray for babies and their moms. And not everyone agrees with us about how important it is to take care of babies and their moms. And so we go downtown in Washington, D.C. once a year with a lot of other people who do agree with us to kind of show the country that it's really important to stand up for babies, including before they're born, and to protect and support their mothers. I do have three kids. My kids are young. They're in preschool, and then I have two in elementary school. So my experience as a mother is also, you know, will inform my work here at the March for Life. And then now, as of 3 days ago, I'm leading this wonderful, historic pro-life organization, the March for Life. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about this organization, because even I honestly didn't know the full extent of what the March for Life organization does until I joined the board about a year ago and then more recently became the new president. Of course, we're best known for the event that shares our name, the National March for Life. And this event, the National March, was started the year after Roe versus Wade by a government lawyer named Nellie Gray. She continued to run the March for Life until she passed away in 2012. So for nearly 40 years, this incredible, tireless woman started and then ran and kind of built up and grew this amazing event, the March for Life. She and her friends had an idea after the Roe versus Wade decision that they needed to get together and show our elected officials and show the Supreme Court that not all Americans were going to accept the Roe versus Wade regime that basically legalized abortion on demand. And their little idea, what started out as just a, you know, a kind of a handful of people demonstrating by the Supreme Court, has grown over the last 52 years or so into something absolutely incredible. Now the March for Life is the world's largest annual human rights demonstration. There is nothing in the world like the March for Life. There's no other movement in history that for over 50 years, every year, has been turning people out by the tens of thousands, sometimes 100,000. At really a time of year where the weather is not always very good, to be honest. But the marchers are not deterred, because this is a group of people and a movement that just cares so deeply about this incredibly important human rights issue of protecting the unborn. When Nellie Gray passed in 2012, Jeannie Mancini took over the organization, and she led the March for Life again until just a few days ago. In addition to the National March, which is by far our most visible and our biggest event every year, the March for Life organization also does state marches. So I would invite all of you who I know are located all over the country to take a look at our website, marchforlife.org, and you can see a list of the states where we currently have state marches. I believe we have 17 teed up for this coming year, for 2025. I'll be attending a lot of them myself. As a speaker and to be meeting supporters. I can't get to every single one of them, especially because since I do have kids at home. But our team goes out to all of these marches and works with local partners, local and state level Christian organizations or pro-life organizations, to demonstrate at state capitals so that we're showing state elected officials and state cultural leaders, just like we do on the national level, that the pro-life movement is really motivated and is still here, is still vocal, is going to keep standing up for moms and their babies until we achieve full protections for the unborn. That state march program, we have big plans to continue to grow it so that, you know, before too long, we aim to be in all 50 states, again, just, demonstrating and standing up for the unborn in state capitals across the country. I'm really excited about that element of our work. We have a small policy team here, so we engage on Capitol Hill and with the White House on pro-life policy, and given my own background and my deep relationships and friendships with some of the folks who have gone into this new administration and this new White House, I think our organization and I personally will be pretty engaged. I have been pretty engaged and will continue to be pretty engaged in policy conversations. And we were honored to have at the March for Life, we'll talk about this in a minute, but not just the president and the vice president represented, but some of the key policy team from the White House came to the March for Life this year as well, just to show their commitment to working on pro-life policy. I will say a lot of the March for Life's programming and engagement in the early years of the organization was heavily Catholic. That's in part because Nellie Gray, the founder, was a Catholic. And so as she initially built the organization out just with her own friends and her own network, that was largely Catholic. But over the years, it's really become a wonderfully, just a beautifully ecumenical program, and we are committed, and I am committed to continuing to expand the ecumenical nature and the diversity of the March for Life, just to show again the full diversity of the pro-life movement and all of the different people who care about the unborn. This year, Wheaton College, an evangelical college in Illinois, led the March for Life. So they got to carry our banner at the front of the march. They had a student leader who was able to give remarks at the rally. Every year we choose a university to kind of be the leaders of the March for Life to represent all of the young people who come to the march. And we were really excited to have an evangelical college leading the march this year. So this brings me to this year's National March, which took place on Friday, January 24th, just a few days after the inauguration. And although the inauguration had to be moved indoors because of the cold, as you all saw, thanks be to God, it warmed up in Washington quite a bit. It was not balmy. It definitely still felt like winter, but it was tolerable by Friday, and we were able to hold the March for Life outdoors as we had planned. It really would be impossible to bring it inside anyway, given the size of the crowd. So that was a real blessing from God that just a few days after the indoors inauguration, we had the, you know, just a perfectly nice kind of clear, sunny winter day on that Friday. And we had an incredibly epic day. I still smile about it every time I think about this year's March for Life, both because of the speakers on the stage and the size and the energy and the youthfulness of the crowd that came to march with us. In terms of speakers, one of our featured speakers was Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, who's obviously, you know, a popular and highly visible governor and who worked really, really hard alongside his wife, Mrs. DeSantis, in Florida to defeat a terrible, really aggressive kind of abortion rights ballot measure in Florida. Governor DeSantis played a big role in just making sure the voters of Florida were getting truthful information about what they were being asked to vote on, and he helped cut through all of the lies kind of promoted by the left and by the media. So we were so thrilled that he and his family joined us for the march this year. This year was actually the first year ever that both the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Thune, and the Speaker of the House, Speaker Mike Johnson, addressed the March for Life. In past years, we've occasionally had a Speaker of the House. We've occasionally had the Senate Majority Leader, although not even very often. But this is the first year that they both came. Speaker Johnson, who's, you know, a wonderful Christian man and such a strong leader and person of faith, he shared a story at the march that he is the product of an unplanned teen pregnancy. And he shared, I thought, really movingly about how grateful he is to his parents, who when they were teenagers and surprised and afraid to be expecting a baby, they chose life, and that was his life. And praise God that they made that courageous choice, because he is such an important leader for our country right now. And then they went on to have several other children, and it sounds like he was raised in a beautiful family, but his sharing of that story, I thought, was really very impactful. And if you haven't seen his remarks, Speaker Johnson's remarks are on our website, or you can just find them on YouTube if you want to hear him tell that story. Vice President J.D. Vance spoke at the March for Life in person this year. He chose the March for Life as his first public event after the inauguration festivities, and that, too, I think is so powerful. What he said was beautiful. He gave a really strong message about protecting the unborn. He said America is fundamentally a pro-life and pro-family country, and we're not going to back away from that. But he also talked quite a bit, and again, really powerfully, about how important it is to just stand with vulnerable mothers and vulnerable families while they're expecting a baby, and then after, you know, after a baby is born. And he committed the administration, again, both to protecting the unborn through strong pro-life policies, but also to thinking creatively about how to make sure that we're supporting families so that mothers feel empowered and supported in choosing life. So it was really, what he said was really powerful, but maybe even more powerful, I think, is just the fact that he was there, again, within just a few days of being inaugurated as the Vice President of the United States, in a week where everybody wants a piece of the Vice President, right, and the President, and they have so many things on their calendars. His team reached out to me and said, you know, the Vice President wants to be at the March for Life. There's nowhere else he'd rather be as he settles into being the VP. And he promised from the stage this year that he'll be back, and I think he will be. So we're really excited to have him as an ally, hopefully for many, many years to come, given his youth and his, you know, bright future, I think, as a political leader. The President was in North Carolina visiting hurricane and flooding victims there, and then flew across the country to California on the day of the March for Life to be present with and the wildfire victims in California. So he wasn't able to be at the march in person, but he sent over a video that's just a few minutes long. And again, you can find it online. But again, just really strong, beautiful message of support from President Trump, who governed as a strongly pro-life president, who in 2020 became the first president ever to attend the March for Life in person. I was able to go in the presidential motorcade that day with a number of other staff to the March for Life in 2020 when I worked in the White House. And it was a really exciting day. And the president was so happy to be with the marchers at the March for Life. So although this year he couldn't be there in person because he needed to prioritize disaster response, rightly so, he sent a great video, again, just kind of reaffirming his commitment to solidarity with the pro-life movement and to standing with the unborn and their moms. So that was really beautiful, too. Our very exciting kind of cultural speaker, you know, we've talked a lot about politicians, but a professional surfer named Bethany Hamilton spoke at the March for Life this year. She's most famous for surviving a shark attack as a teenage surfer and then making an incredible comeback. She's still a professional athlete. She's now a mother of four children who she brought with her from Hawaii for the march. She's been a reality television star. She's a motivational speaker. There's a movie about her life, Soul Surfer. So we were delighted to discover that a lot of, especially our younger marchers, were so happy to hear from Bethany as she talked about her journey of motherhood and growing into being a mother and really just embracing the beauty of life and of family life and of being a mom. We heard from an abortion survivor, a doctor who used to perform abortions until she had a conversion and now she speaks out against them. We had a beautiful presentation from a mother of a child who had had a bad diagnosis during pregnancy, and the mom chose life for the little girl, and this little girl, Verity, was with her. She's such a beautiful, sweet child. And then I had an opportunity for the first time, you know, of course, I've been in that March for Life crowd, I don't know, so many times since I first came in 2001. But this was my first chance to get on stage and give my own remarks and greet the marchers. And that was so much fun, too, just to see the big, energetic crowd, everyone holding up their signs, a lot of homemade signs, lots of groups from colleges and high schools, lots of groups from churches, people who have been marching for 50 years. I love being able to pick them out of the crowd. And I just took the opportunity, you know, to introduce myself and encourage the marchers, but also just to push back a little bit on some of what I think is really damaging and frankly offensive messaging that we heard quite a bit from the left during the presidential campaign, especially about how women and men need abortion essentially in order to be able to accomplish anything in life, right? So you heard messaging like, do you want to be able to get an education? Women, do you want to have a path to economic empowerment? You need to be able to rely on abortion, essentially because your own children are going to stand in the way of, you know, fulfilling your fulfillment and flourishing. So I was able to go on stage with my own children and my husband and just speak directly to all of the young women at the march and just tell them, you know, hey, don't let anybody tell you that you're not strong enough to be a mom and follow your dream, right? You can be a mom and get an education. You can get a mom, be a mom and have a wonderful career as I have. You can be a mom and find so much happiness and fulfillment and flourishing, and you are strong enough to do that, even if some people are trying to sell you short and tell you that you're not strong enough and you need to choose abortion, you need to choose to kill your baby. And then similar message for young men as well. So we had a really great day. And coming out of that day, I think we had just turning to the future. I feel so much momentum right now for the pro-life movement and the cause of life, which is really encouraging coming after a time, you know, a couple of years after the Dobbs decision where we were seeing some losses, some hard losses in the states on ballot measures and constitutional amendments that voters were voting on. And the cause of life wasn't winning for a while there, I think, as America was trying to kind of sort out what Dobbs meant and how Americans were trying to kind of cut through all the noise from the media that doesn't tell the truth about what the ballot measures meant or about access to medical care for women, even in pro-life states and these sorts of things. But this year, of course, you know, we saw great wins in Florida and in Nebraska and South Dakota on state-level policy initiatives. And Americans rejected Kamala Harris's really extreme abortion agenda that she really put at the centerpiece of her campaign, right? She kind of made a big gamble and ran on abortion and I guess thought that that's what Americans wanted, but it is not what Americans wanted. And, of course, there's many reasons that President Trump won re-election. Many, many reasons. But I do think among them is that, you know, he had a strong pro-life record from his first administration that was set against this policy platform of essentially unlimited access to abortion at any time for any reason, which Americans do not want and which they rejected. So that gives us a lot of great momentum. In his first week in office, President Trump pardoned 23 peaceful pro-life protesters who had been targeted and prosecuted by the Biden administration and put in prison. They were all pardoned by President Trump the day before the March for Life, which was beautiful. On the day of the march, he signed a couple of executive actions ensuring that U.S. taxpayer dollars aren't going to be used to pay for or promote abortions, which is really important as well. Stepping us away from what's already been done and, again, just kind of looking to the future, I think as a movement, certainly we as an organization at the March for Life, as I take the reins here, we're going to stay focused on our twin objectives, right, these two goals that go hand in hand of protecting the unborn and supporting vulnerable moms. 60% of women who have chosen abortion say that they would have chosen life for their baby if they felt like they had more material support and more emotional support. That statistic is something I think about a lot because it's so tragic, and I think it's also a real call to action for those of us who care about the cause of life, that we individually, we as organizations, we as churches, really just need to be standing with vulnerable women, right, and making sure that they feel emotionally supported, right? They feel like there's someone who has their back and is going to walk with them through a hard pregnancy, an unexpected pregnancy, and need to make sure they can find material resources to help them. Pregnancy resource centers, church groups that can lend a hand, just somewhere where they can get diapers and a crib and a car seat and clothes for their baby, and again, just kind of feel that support. So that's, again, I think a call to action for us that we need to stay focused on is resourcing moms and then continuing to fight for protections in law for the unborn. So we'll continue to do that. Our specific priorities include protecting women from the harms of the chemical abortion pill, which, you know, continues to hurt women because those are really strong drugs and they're dangerous drugs. And the left has been telling women that they're totally safe to use with no doctor's involvement and just use them at home like it's Advil, basically. That's really harmful. So we're going to be pushing for more protections for women from the harms of the chemical abortion pill. We'll continue to make sure that taxpayer dollars don't go to fund abortions, and keep just spreading the message of hope and joy and love that life is beautiful even when it's hard, and that women are strong, and to just help them be empowered to choose, again, choose life for their babies. And church groups and pastors like you all are so critical in this fight. So I'm really grateful for your care about this issue and your leadership on it with your own communities. And thanks for the invitation to join you and talk about this today. I'm happy to take a few minutes of questions if anyone has questions or wants to offer me, you know, some feedback. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is inspiring and encouraging on a whole number of levels, Jenny. So thank you very much. Well, folks, press *6 to get in queue to ask any question. Of course, the pro-life movement to me is really, it is the cornerstone movement of the conservative movement. We are conservative. We are conservative because we are pro-life in part. Let me begin with this question. There's a lot of discussion about politicians trying to run away from the life movement because they thought it was a loser electorally. Where do we stand with that now? Are we going to, for example, in the congressional elections, is it going to be a downplaying of the life issue? Do you see it as coming back, or is people thinking, well, you know, we actually, it's a winning issue? Just give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think this is one of the big challenges for the movement. You're right. There was this kind of general sense among politicians that they had to back away from being openly pro-life, right? But what we've seen, I have seen some data, especially coming out of the last election, it's just not true that politicians who are strongly and vocally pro-life end up losing their elections, right? Governor DeSantis won re-election on a strong pro-life record. Governor Kemp in Georgia has a strong pro-life record. There's governors all over the country, as well as members of the House and senators, who have pro-life records and who haven't lost their seats because of that. So I think part of what we here in Washington need to work on and are working on with our friends in politics, and what you all can do as well in terms of your elected officials, is just make sure they're hearing that this is all kind of, you know, this concern maybe isn't borne out in the data, that if you are an elected official who delivers for your constituents, you're not going to lose a raise because of your pro-life commitments. And I do think that we will see a little bit of a vibe shift on that now that we have come out of an election, again, where a few ballot measures won at the states, and where Kamala Harris's, her big gamble, right, didn't pay off. And President Trump, although during the election he was downplaying his own pro-life commitments, his record was his record. And I think everybody knew that he had governed as a pro-life president. He had put pro-life justices on the Supreme Court. And now he came out of the gate again, just going right back to picking up where he left off 4 years ago with a lot of pro-life policy wins. So I very much hope that we will see that start to change and there won't be politicians backing away from this issue. But it is really important that we all who are constituents keep pushing them on it. And again, just make help them to think about this. Like, have you seen people losing because they're pro-life? No, we have not actually been seeing that in America.
Okay, my second question is, there have been reports, and you probably know this better than we do, but there have been reports that since the overturning of Roe v. Wade, because of chemical abortions, even though some states have completely outlawed abortion, that we've got more abortions happening than were happening even before Roe v. Wade. A, is that true? And B, if it is true, how do we address that?
Yeah. That's another great question. The data is a little bit tricky, is my understanding, because not all states report their abortion data, first of all, to the federal government. And the states that do report it, you know, there's some sense that maybe the data is incomplete. And then chemical abortions, again, it's hard to get exact numbers because at this point, women don't have, thanks to the Biden administration removing every little bit of protection around, you know, around access to that pill, women don't even have to be seeing a doctor in person to get the chemical abortion pill. So the first thing I'll say is it's hard to know exactly the story the numbers are telling. But we did see in CDC data, this is federal government data that came out just before Thanksgiving, in states with strong pro-life laws, it does look like the abortion rate has started to tick down. So that's good to know, right, that pro-life laws do have an impact, of course. But yes, it does seem to be the case that as more and more abortions in the U.S. are shifting to chemical abortions, that number is going up because it's so easy to access the chemical abortion pill at this point. You can get it by mail, you can get it through telemedicine, whatever. That is a real, that's a concern, and it's real, it causes me a lot of heartache, not just because of all the lives lost to chemical abortion, but again, because I think women are just being lied to by, to some degree, the medical establishment and certainly by, you know, by the left, that this is really safe and essentially consequence-free. And so that's why you don't have to see a doctor. You can take it at home. But we know that's not true. And we have seen stories, you know, in the media about women who took the chemical abortion pill at home and were harmed by it or even lost their lives by it. So one thing I think is something that's really on our agenda and on my agenda here, along with a lot of others in the movement, is once we have an HHS secretary, whether that's RFK who being confirmed or if he doesn't get confirmed, it'll be someone else, to really start drilling down and prioritizing with the government. First of all, if they're not ready to take the chemical abortion pill off the market entirely, at a minimum, to put a lot of protections back in place around it so that women have to be working with a medical professional, having an in-person appointment before they can access it. That's all like kind of just the basic matters of health and safety for women. But that will also, I believe, that will help drive the rate of abortions down, of abortions through chemical, using the chemical abortion pill regime. And then the other thing that I think is really important to do is to get the word out as far and wide as possible that it is actually possible to reverse a chemical abortion if a woman has taken the first pill but not yet the second pill. There is a period of time where if a mom realizes that she actually, you know, she's changing her mind or she's feeling some regret, there is a way to reverse the chemical abortion regime, and there are doctors, pro-life doctors, who are willing to work with women on that. But some states are actually trying to outlaw access to the abortion pill reversal regime, which is completely outrageous. And so I think that's another priority, just making sure that women have that option and realize that they do have a shot at saving their baby's life even after they've taken that first pill, as long as they know who to call. And can access that medication right away. So we want to do that too, again, just to make sure that women have that option available to them.
Wow, Jenny, that breaks news. I didn't know that. I didn't know it was reversible. Mm-hmm. That is important. You're right. Everybody needs to know that. So that is great. Okay, we've got a caller on the line. Let's go to Jose in California. Jose, welcome.
Right ahead.
Jose, you there? Okay. Go ahead, Jose.
Jose took his phone off of mute, and I'm calling from California. I got a couple questions and an encouragement for our speaker. First of all, thank you so much for that, your leadership. For many years, for the decades, we've been faithful and loyal to these families. And I want to comment that there's also a life chain event that used to be very popular up here in Northern California and has dwindled over the decades, which is really sad. So I just want to encourage the March for Life. Thank you so much. And we've got the Walk for Life up here as well, President Lichter, in San Francisco, which is just a tremendous outpouring. My question for you is, can you recommend any drugstore? Can you endorse any drugstore? Because I have gone to our local drugstores and asked the pharmacist point blank, do you sell mifepristone or misoprostone or misoprostol, which are the hormones for these Plan B morning after chemical abortion? And sometimes they'll say, oh, we don't sell that. And I'm like, how about Plan B morning after pill? And they're like, oh, yeah, we sell that. So, you know, it's a lot of intellectual dishonesty. And I tell these pharmacists, I'm not going to support your business and boycott you because you're an abortion company, right? I mean, Costco does the same thing. Every drugstore up here. And our governor, Governor Newsom, he forced Walgreens and other states to, where it was illegal to offer the chemical abortion, he said, you have to offer it there against the law in those states. Otherwise, I will withdraw our contract in California. So God bless you and have a great day.
Thank you, Jose.
Wow. Wow. Thanks, Jose, for the encouragement. And that's it's a great question. I'm sorry to say that I don't know of any drugstore chains, certainly, that are not currently selling, as you said, Plan B, the morning after pill, at a minimum. And even, I imagine that in some places, in some states, there are local pharmacies that don't. But I'll tell you, even my wonderful neighborhood local pharmacy that my family relies on, sell you right behind the counter, just sitting there waiting for anyone to walk in and buy it, is the morning after pill, is Plan B. So that is a real problem, and I'm with you. I appreciate your goal and your intention of supporting life-affirming businesses. But it's difficult because this is so widespread, I think, in the pharmacy industry at this point.
Yeah, Jenny, just before we let you go, I believe that we've got to move toward a culture of life, and I've heard you say that in effect. And I think we often get bogged down on reproductive rights and, oh, no, it's not. And we argue at the margins over when a baby feels pain and when can it survive outside the mother's womb. And not that those things are unimportant, but ultimately what we want to do, I've likened it to slavery. What we want people to do is to come to a sense of moral conscience that is simply wrong, and it's nothing that we should be supporting. We've been talking about a constitutional matter. By the way, I used to be a lawyer in a former life. But
we have that in common.
But we've been looking at a constitutional amendment that declares life and personhood at conception, because whether constitutionally or just culturally, that's really where we need to go, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm with you 100%. I mean, that's the ultimate goal. And I'll tell you, when I worked in the White House, I looked at that a little bit, just kind of talking with some folks and thinking, like, is this a moment where there might be an opportunity to kind of push for a personhood amendment. I think the political landscape is probably not quite the right moment to kind of go full steam on that, because you don't want to try something like that and have it run into a lot of headwinds and then you can't really try again. But I'm 100% with you. And I think given the momentum that we're starting to see right now, it'll be really interesting to see what kinds of opportunities there are in the next few years, because you're right. In the end, what we're trying to do, when people in the movement talk about changing hearts and minds, what we're trying to do is just help people recognize the beauty and the dignity of every human life, born and unborn, and again, the dignity of pregnant women who need a lot of support too, so that they can choose to keep their baby, which is what most women want to do in the absence of, financial or other pressures. So I'm with you, and I appreciate those comments. Thank you.
Well, Jenny, thank you for all that you are doing. We'll keep you posted, because what we want to do really is change the debate and start talking more about what is that the woman is carrying. I mean, it's not a blob, it's not a fetus, it really is a human being. Mm-hmm. In fact, the same way you were when you and I were in our mother's womb, it was us. That at early stages of development. And I think we've got to prick the moral consciences of people to think about that you're doing, as Ronald Reagan said, you know, all the people who support abortion are already born.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yep. That's so, exactly right. Yeah, I'm with you. I look forward to staying in touch.
How can we help you? How can we support your work? What would you ask people to do? I mean,
thank you. Well, again, I'd love to see anyone who can make it out to state marches, whether in your own state or one nearby, because that public witness, especially that collective public witness, is so, so powerful. To just get together in a way that our culture can't ignore and can't deny, right? There was some talk in this past, you know, presidential election cycle, even of, you know, this issue is over, right? As politicians were turning away from, we don't need to talk about that anymore. This issue is over. No, it's not over. And one of the best ways that we can collectively show that it's not over is to keep showing up and standing up at marches for life, you know, big gatherings if you can. But also as important to build the culture of life in your local communities is to show up at pregnancy resource centers or at church programs that support babies and women. So I would just really encourage everyone kind of in whatever vineyard the Lord has given to you, right, to show up in whatever way that you can. And if you ever make it to a March for Life, I'll look forward to meeting you there as we continue to build our outreach and our partnerships. So, and continue
well,
to pray, please, for me and my family. Thank you.
And we will do that, Jenny. I've been to a couple of Marches for Life, and we support our local. My church supports our local one here. Stan's got it. He's a national organization, and so we support the March for Life in whatever way we can. So we'll talk about how we can get even more active with you. But thank you. We've held you over. Thanks so much for taking time with us, Jenny. We'll be praying for your success as the president of the March for Life.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well, folks, I am encouraged by leaders like her, and I think she gets it, too, that, you know, at some point, it may not be the opportune time for pushing it at any given moment, but I just don't know when that time will show up if we don't push it. I do believe that we've got to try to move toward a culture of life. Again, I hope you all get the analogy, but I do liken it to the mentality that supported slavery. And there were all kinds of justifications for it. Well, it's a property rights issue. Well, they're not really human. Well, they're not really like us. Well, you know. I pointed out that even during slavery, there were Black folks who were as brilliant as Ben Carson, but they didn't get that opportunity to demonstrate their capability because they were caught up in the ideology that said they didn't really have a right to fulfill their God-given potential. And to me, the baby killing industry is an issue that says these children don't have a right to fulfill their God-given potential because they're really kind of the property of the mother and they're not really human. They're not really people. All of these justifications that really speak to a moral blindness. And we've got to get the moral blindness ripped off people's eyes so they can see the monstrousness of what we are doing in killing all these innocent unborn children. As I said, the question that boils down to each of us was conceived. At what point was it not you? At what point was it not you? Well, obviously, it was you from the moment you were conceived in your mother's womb. And you just went through various stages of development. But it was you all the time. So we are really wiping out human beings who have immense potential to be a blessing to us, to our country, to humanity. And we are destroying their lives out of some kind of demonic, deceptive ideology that makes us think, well, no, this is acceptable. It's in fact, I would argue it's worse than slavery because at least slavery was not inherently the killing of a human being, just the appropriation of a human being for one's own selfish ends. This is the killing of a human being for one's own selfish ends, and it's got to stop. So stand by because we're going to be offering our amendment, understanding it's a long shot to have an amendment passed, but at the very least, I want to have the debate about when life begins and what a person is and how in the world do you ever say that that baby is not a person. That baby is not life. How do you ever say that? It doesn't make any sense at all. Well, listen, we are going to host a discussion on the family, a panel discussion that's going to be live streamed. Go to our website to find out more about it. It's called The Crisis of the American Family on Thursday. It's just 2 days from now at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. We invite all of you to watch. You will have an email address that we will give where you can actually make comments, ask questions, and we will respond to the audience. We have four panelists and I think three or four responders, and then we'll take questions from the audience as well. I am convinced, look, it is the brokenness of the family that is driving abortion. I mean, how many abortions are had by happily married women? I guarantee you, precious few. I mean, it is an industry for single-parent, female-headed households, women who are single, young women who just don't want to have a baby at that time, whatever. I'm not saying married women never have an abortion, but I'm saying that's in the distinct minority. This is a problem of lack of family formation and the sacredness of marriage and all of those things that make for a stable and civilized society. And so we're going to have a discussion about that and how we rebuild the family. I hope all of you will take time to join in with us. I think it's going to be a very, very exciting and I think groundbreaking discussion because, look, we're having all of this controversy over RFK. I support his nomination, by the way, but we're having all this controversy over him and over the pharmaceutical industry and over the additives in our foods and all that. But one of the major issues that Health and Human Services needs to address is the breakdown of the family. And I don't think government can solve that problem, but I think government can in some ways get out of the way of solving that problem and try to help those who are trying to solve the problem. Because if we don't solve that problem, all the other social issues that we're having, they are only going to get worse. Because the broken family feeds them all. And again, you can just run down the list: crime, violence, prison overpopulation, alcoholism, drug addiction, drug overdoses, domestic abuse, mental illness, academic failure, poverty, suicide, and yes, abortion, all driven by the broken family. We got to address it, and nobody else is doing it, frankly. We're going to do it. So we need your help. We need your prayers. We need your support. That's Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, live streamed at our various venues. The flyer is on our website, standamerica.us. Thanks, everybody. God bless you. Thank you all so much. You all encourage me, and I appreciate you because I know you have committed yourselves. That's why you're on this call and we're doing what you do, to stand up, to step up, to speak up, to refuse to back up. We're learning, too. We're seeing it demonstrated by President Trump and his administration. We cannot be defeated if we will not quit, because we are on God's side. God bless everybody.